You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a fire ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Welcome back for another episode of The Spear, a production of the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm Dr. Charles Faint, your host, and today I'm assisted by Cadet Sebastian Witt. Our guest for this episode is Command Sergeant Major Alex Cuprati, the Command Sergeant Major of the 4th Infantry Division. Sergeant Major Cuprati enlisted in the Army after a year at the Virginia Military Institute. After initial entry training, he was immediately assigned to the 75th Ranger Regiment, where he spent most of the next 20 years of his military career, culminating in the position of Command Sergeant Major of the 2nd Ranger Battalion. He is now the Command Sergeant Major of the 4th Infantry Division, and he joined the podcast on the eve of the recent Army-Air Force football game. On today's episode, Command Sergeant Major Cuprati discusses the value of interoperability, partnerships, innovation, and the officer-NCO relationship to the modern combat experience. Hey, Sergeant Major, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Charlie. Happy to be here.
So what brings you to West Point today?
Well, I mean, we're fortunate for West Point to be using the 4th Infantry Division to represent them in this upcoming game against the Air Force, and looking forward to my first experience in an Army football game, so pretty excited.
We were talking about before the show started, I didn't go to school here, and I remember the first time I came, and it was the Army football weekend, and I sat with the Corps cadets, and what a great experience. So I think you and your team are in for a real treat.
Oh, we're stoked. We're looking forward to it, yes.
Yeah, Army's 8-0 going into this game?
It is, and you know, we're fortunate enough last year when they came down to the Springs and they defeated an undefeated at the time Air Force. So, and that was under the 4th ID patch. So we're hoping to repeat that again today.
But lightning strikes twice, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I remember the game you're talking about. It was a huge upset over Air Force last
Significant.
Year.
Significant. Yeah, absolutely. Hey, go Army.
Go Army. Go Army indeed.
Absolutely.
So we were talking before the show kind of about your background and your experiences leading up to you being the Sergeant Major of the 4th Infantry Division. So can you tell us a little bit about why you decided to join? What was your decision process like in your early years in the Army?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in Lima, Peru, actually South America. When I was 12, I immigrated to the United States just for every other reason that everyone immigrates here, land of opportunity. Quickly joined a JROTC program in high school. And that was my first introduction to the military. And I had a pretty good mentor there. I was a retired First Sergeant, Airborne Ranger, 82nd Airborne Division, who talked about the profession of arms and what it means to give back to your country. At the time, you know, the U.S. had given me and my family so many opportunities. What better way to give back than becoming, you know, a soldier? And I chose this profession, thinking it was going to be a 3-4 year gig. I first joined on a RIP contract at the time, the Ranger Indoctrination Program, Option 40, which put me straight into the 75th Ranger Regiment. I continued to stay there. I liked the mission set. And 20 years later, I managed to stay there from PFC, culminating as a Command Sergeant Major of the 2nd Ranger Battalion. Really, what kept me in the service as long, what continues to keep me in the service, really, I truly believe in the mission and what the U.S. stands for. I believe in its people and taking care of its families. And and the constant transformation that keeps this profession really exciting.
That is such an interesting experience. You said that you joined the Ranger Regiment as your first duty station as a PFC. Did you come in with some additional rank because of your junior ROTC experience?
I did not. No, there was none of that. And truth be told, I left high school, graduated high school, and I went to Virginia Military Institute for a year.
Okay.
So I was there for a year, and it was my sophomore year when I realized, after spending a lot of time in ROTC with an SF instructor, a Ranger instructor, that is exactly kind of what I wanted to do at the time. And I chose to pursue the enlisted. But no additional credit given, unfortunately.
Okay, so what was it like to go to one of the top performing units in the Army for your first duty station?
It was tough. The regiment has changed its assessment and selection programs. This was back in 96. I remember it was survival of the fittest. But I knew the caliber of soldier that they built. I knew the mission set, the premier, raid force in the United States Army. So I knew I was going to be among type A personalities who trusted the profession, valued everything the Army stood for. And it was challenging. I said, there's nothing challenging more than being in the Ranger Regiment. And as I mentioned before, I had a couple of NCOs that told me that's where you need to go if you want to be at the very top of your game. So.
And did you find that when you got to the regiment? Did you think that it lived up to that type of hype?
Oh, absolutely. I think the 20 years I spent there made me the NCO, really the father that I am now, the leader that I am today. I've had some phenomenal leaders, both in the NCO and officers, who have kind of really shaped me. And also fortunate enough to be across all four Ranger battalions. So I get to see a lot of the different changes, the different personalities, the different ways of accomplishing the mission, but all fighting towards a common core, a common purpose. Majority of it, which was spent during the GWAT, arguably one of the most deployed units in the United States Army.
For sure.
So, absolutely.
And when you were in the Ranger Regiment, did you ever think about leaving to go do something else, or were you do the regiment all the way?
Yeah, nobody wants to leave the regiment. But, absolutely, but we have our charters, and Abrams Charter, entrusts us to go out in the conventional army and really share some of the SOPs and TTPs for which the regiment was designed to create. So eventually, I did leave the regiment. I left really as a brand new sergeant major, just finishing my. Completing brigade ops or major, regimental ops or major time. And I did my first tour in the Bronco Brigade, that 325. So I was able to become a squadron CSM there before being able to compete and become the 2nd Ranger Battalion CSM.
Wow.
And that's a great thing. The charters are there for a reason. And I think it does make the Army better to share as NCOs and officers.
So can you explain the charter a little bit to our readers who aren't familiar with it and how that involves folks going to the Ranger Regiment and back out to the force?
That's right. So right now it's... Unless it's changed in the last few years, which I don't think it has, after you leave your first on time, before you go beyond to become a battalion CSM, you must have gone out and served a minimum of a year in some form, shape, or form in a conventional unit. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a battalion or a company. It can be, we have Rangers that serve everywhere in MCOE, particularly in Fort Moore. But that gives you the opportunity to see the bigger picture. It gives you the opportunity to share some of those lessons and things learned. In my case, I was able to spend 2 years out in a conventional, a cavalry squadron, actually. So that is a requirement before you're able to come back and then assess once again. And that's what makes that organization so much better, is you're constantly being assessed, at the E7, at the E8, and 89, because the standards are the standards and you're held to them, whether you're a private or you're the colonel of the 75th.
That sounds like a great unit to be in, Sergeant Major.
Absolutely.
So as we were talking before, this is the spear and the story of the combat experience. And if few minutes, we're going to get to some of your stories about interoperability, partnership, and other experiences you had downrange. But I think our readers would also be interested in what your experience has been like coming from the Ranger Regiment for 20 years, and now you are a conventional division sergeant major. What have you found your experiences in the 4th Infantry Division to be like?
My time so far, going in 2 years now, have been amazing. Very different than the past as a brigade CSM. I was a brigade CSM in Alaska in 211, which I guess the artists formerly known as 425, since they flagged as the 11th Airborne Division. But really, that was actually my first exposure to BSBs, FA battalions, and those don't reside inside the regiment. And now, looking at the division, you have, I have an armor brigade combat team, I have a cab, the DSB. So really, it's a steep learning curve, but I have phenomenal leaders, and really, it's how much time you dedicate to learning your formations, talking to junior soldiers, talking to the mid-level leadership, and understanding what their mission set is, that has allowed me to wrap happily get caught up and understand what their purpose, task and purpose is in the division.
You know. And as you know, here at West Point, cadets will soon be doing their branching and their posting, mm-hmm. and which is a pretty incredible experience. I encourage you to come back if you haven't seen it before to watch them pick their units off the board. It's like NFL draft.
I heard it's about incredible. Today, yes.
Oh, you heard about it?
Fascinating, yeah. One of them was explaining it to me today as we were walking to lunch. It sounds fascinating, yeah. I would love to come back for that.
So 4th ID is one of the top units selected. It's got a very high reputation here, both because of what you all do in your unit and the location. All right, so Sergeant Major, I think we'll transition now to your experiences downrange, and we'll take this in whatever direction you like to take it. So when we're talking about leadership, what have your experiences taught you downrange that are important for these folks to learn?
Oh gosh, there's so many things. So yeah, I mean, things are more volatile, I think, than they've ever been. 20 years of GWAD, I think nowadays we're more busy than we have been there. But things have changed. Operational concept has changed from the coin to multi-domain operational large-scale combat. So the Army is going through a lot of changes right now. The division itself prides itself in its close proximity to all our partner units to exercise some of the multi-domain operations that you're seeing right now. I would focus right now, and you know, as we discussed earlier on in the interoperability piece, because that, surprisingly enough, has not changed. It's never going to change, and it's something that we need to become very, very familiar and accustomed and comfortable with doing. As you know, we only have so many soldiers in the Army. We can only be spread out so thin. And the goal is really to build and empower a lot of this partner and ally nations to do some of the work that they habitually ask us to assist. So I can go back to the GWAD, and this is applicable to both Afghanistan and Iraq. Our ability to work with the forces, the specific country, train them in the specific type of missions that we as Rangers in the 75th, very surgical, very precise. That was the main focus for us, because we understood that at some point our focus will change. We understood at some point the regime may shift to a different area of the world because of different issues. So it was imperative to build a solid foundation inside this specialty units inside of both Afghanistan and Iraq. And that is something that really uncomfortable for some of us. You know, that's a mission set that is typically reserved for special forces. But we took on the challenge, understanding that the more effort we put into developing these units, the easier it's going to be for us to transition when the time did come. Now, you fast forward to what we're doing right now, what we're doing in the Baltics, what we're doing in Poland, and to an extent, what we're doing in Ukraine. And, you know, interoperability has not changed. And the requirement for us to learn the SOPs and TTPs so we can easily meld into this war plans, should they come to fruition at some point, is more imperative. And they're hungry for it. All these nations are building their armies, you know, relying on the expertise and experience of the American soldier, in particular, as non-commissioned officer corps. So now more than ever, I think it's more important to stay the path and continue to work with the partners and allies when it comes to interoperability.
You spent a lot of time in the Ranger Regiment. You mentioned 20 years. So did you see an evolution in the perception of what the Ranger Regiment needs to be successful? I'm thinking about my own experiences in early in the GWAT, where a lot of soft was turning away outside help from the conventional forces. It seems like your regiment, the Rangers, kind of adapted to that early in bringing people in. Is that accurate?
No, that is very accurate. So we never strayed away from the requirement. And, you know, the large-scale combat thing, we talk about it as a brand new concept, but it really has been old for some years. And we've partnered with conventional forces through almost every single deployment that I've been in. I mean, you operate on battle space owners' backyard. So the requirement to be able to fluidly meld formations was critical then, and it's critical now. We carry that over not only in combat, we follow that through with CTC and JRTC, augmenting rotational units. So I think we've done a pretty good job at staying in touch. I mean, and again, back to the charter, that is one of the things we have been entrusted with doing, is developing those TTPs, SOPs, Rangers SOPs, and Ranger doctrine to share with a larger force.
So I think we all agree that interoperability is important, but how do you do it just physically? What do you institute in order to make that interoperability happen?
Well, first and foremost, for us, and I'll tell you, I spent last year with a division. We had the division, our DSB, and our CAB. We were deployed for 9 months in Poland, and now we had the responsibility of across really 5 different countries, the 3 Baltic nations, Poland, as well as Germany. Our main goal was first and foremost, is try to identify the NCO Corps. And I'm telling you, they're doing phenomenal work there. And increasing that and solidifying that structure, you know, they're working towards something that didn't exist before. So creating subject matter expertise across the board, whether it was in armor formation, artillery formation, or dismounted infantry formations, was the first thing we wanted to do. And it's still under the requirement that your senior NCOs are the ones that drive the training. So that was our first focus. Obviously, personnel followed by systems. That now you start getting into the challenging portion is how they used to operate. They're much different than we are. How they use their C2 infrastructure is much different. So those were really the two next challenges that we tackle there. We still have a little bit to go, but I think we've come a long way in the last few years. And I mean, that's due to the existential threat, obviously, but really from developing SMEs inside the formation, small units, to train larger units, to identifying some of those systems, particularly in C2, that we needed to fix. So the interoperability is much more fluid. It's kind of what the focus was.
Sergeant Major, it's interesting that you brought up the NCO Corps. So, of course, in the Army, NCOs are the backbone of our Army. And a critique of many foreign armies, including some of the European ones, is they don't rely or utilize their NCO Corps or develop them very well. It sounds like from what you're saying that that's shifting or is no longer the case. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely, yes. So they've changed. Because I was part of the division that was running the operations in the northern portion of Victory North, where 5th Corps is in charge, I was able to engage with a lot of the SMA, the Sergeant Majors of those armies, and every senior NCO, both Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Poland. And a lot of them are all graduates from the Sergeant Major Academy. So they are putting a stronger focus in developing their NCOs. And they're starting at the very top. They're developing their leadership development programs or their NCOES, much like we have, BLC, SLC, targeting that mid-level leadership who in turn will hopefully fill those ranks that they have right now. So that was really exciting to see. And every opportunity that we actually have to bring them into a lot of the schools we have, both here as well as the tactical schools like Airborne, Air Assault, it's mm-hmm. just more opportunities to show them because they're exposed. Who are the primary trainers? They're all NCOs. So we have to model and continue to model that all the time. And I think that's gone a long way for them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a couple of examples of how you saw that interoperability manifest itself in combat? Some things that you saw that it's like, hey, we are a lot more successful because we're working together.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely. Tactically, it's really the trust mm-hmm. gain, first and foremost. You know, it's nobody wants to give up the lead. You know, that was one of the biggest things with us. And, you know, as a Ranger First Sergeant, as a CSM, I used to tell our companies and our, you know, and our platoons, I was like, we're going to leave at some point. You have to let these soldiers take lead, right? And that takes a lot of trust. And how do you overcome that? It's training. We spend a lot of time training. We spend a lot of time empowering the leaders. We spend a lot of time putting them in difficult situations. So they're forced to make decisions. And sometimes they failed. And sometimes they did really well. But we set the conditions in a training environment. So when you actually went in and got into a two live fire game, on target, they were very confident. And we saw the confidence over time. I mean, 20 years, it wasn't overnight. I mean, towards the end of our deployments, you had these guys that were upset because they were in the lead element making contact. And they're the ones that were, you know, adjusting fire, granted their own from their own assets. So it was great to see the transformation over the years. So it did work out in the end.
Excellent. Okay. And then fast forward from your time in the Ranger Regiment, you said you spent some considerable time in Poland. And that's a pretty hot assignment right now. Lots of units rotating through, obvious threats emanating from Russia, but a lot of other things going on there. So what kind of things were you and your forces doing in Poland?
When it comes to interoperability, really partnering with all the different battalions, the different corps that were out there, really exercising some of the war plans, exercising the staffs being the key thing that we focus as a division headquarters, is how do we ensure that our staffs can communicate and work smoothly. It took a lot of our time. The units do the units' things. Our tank battalions are going to do tank battalion things, or artillery. They take advantage of the land and really the training glide paths that are in there. So many exercises that happen throughout the year that we're able to nest inside of those, either to augment or have some of those units augment our forces as they go through, for example, JMRC. So not so much focus on the down, but mostly in building the staff. So the division core level is where our focus was. And we did that through CPXs and They continue to do that. So obviously we rotated after 9 months. My understanding is they continue to get better and better, which is what we're aiming for.
Nice, nice. We have quite a few foreign cadets here at West Point, including a number of Poles, and they tend to send us their best. So it's interesting that that carried on for your organization when you were over there.
Yeah, those guys are in it to win it. They're very committed. Their nation is very committed. And as you know, obviously, military sales, they want to take everything we have, and they train very hard every day. So
yeah, geographically, they're in a very unfortunate spot, kind of on the main invasion route between Russia and Europe. And I also remember that in recent years, they've been one of the only NATO nations to meet their 2% contribution to GDP.
Now, at this point.
Yeah, right, absolutely. Right, yeah. For sure. Okay. So, Sergeant Major, when we were researching before this interview, looking up stuff about 4ID and its long history, the Ivy Division, it seems now that your division is largely focused on modernization. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the modernization things that are going on with 4ID?
We're invested right now a lot in our multi-domain operations and how we are actually leveraging our location inside Colorado Springs with our Mountain Post partners. We're talking about 4th SFAB, the only space brigade the Army owns is inside Fort Carson, 10th Special Forces Group. We have Buckley, Peterson. So we are able to actually take with, I think what other organizations are using through computer simulation. We have run numerous exercises now, both in Ivy Mass, which is a fire support coordination exercise, and Ivy in Lethal Ivy, which we actually put the division in the dirt with a brigade on the dirt in Pinon Canyon training area to actually utilize all these different assets and actually put them to work. You know, how do we use space? How do we use EW? How do we use cyber? So that's really what the division is really focusing on right now and exercising those things in a live environment, actually on people on the ground. As far as modernization, so we're not in the modern, we make small improvements to modernization. I think the next very big one, Capstone 6.0, I think is the one. We'll be partnering with Army Futures Command here in 2026. That's going to be taking the division out west to California and really stretching the formation over 300 miles. So what are we trying to do is we're trying to test logistics, contested logistics, which is arguably, you know, really where we're gonna fail in large-scale combat. Along the process, the goal is to standardize our C2 structure communications, and that's what kind of what we're looking for when you look at modernization. But the continuous transformation, I tell you, to the chief's number three priority or focus area, that's ongoing. That has not changed. And we always talk to our formations as like, we may not modernize, but what you have right now, when the rest of our cluster goes up, that's what you're going to go with.
That's right.
So you have to take what you have, take care of your equipment, maintenance, sustainment. That's the things we focus on, right? And then when it comes to systems and processes, you know, how are we innovating? How are we making things better? How are we streamlining things and becoming more efficient? So it doesn't necessarily have to be tied to money. And then what's awesome about that is it all comes down from people like future Lieutenant Witz, you know, that are E5s, you know, with the bottom-up feedback and bottom-up refinement, how to do things different. And I think that's the strength right now of our Army is a new generation of soldiers are just so tied into technology. They're like digital natives that kind of facilitate some of this new innovations that we're having.
So you mentioned future Lieutenant Witt, and in May, there's going to be 1,000 new graduates from West Point and countless ROTC OCS as well. So thinking back over the course of your very long career, you've probably had numerous platoon leaders, company commanders, battalion commanders, division commanders at this point. What is your ideal NCO officer relationship like?
Oh my gosh, it's really based in creating a mutual respect and understanding what it is that is expected of you. What do you expect of your NCO? And you know, at the same time, you have to ask them, what do you expect of me as a platoon leader? You know, you are, at the end of the day, the leader of your formation. But I think you need to have a good relationship with the NCO, as he is always, will always be the conduit of information to the younger soldiers in your formation. He is more in tune. He's been there. He's been a private. He's been a specialist in E5. So solidifying that that through good counseling and good understanding of what you expect of him or her is critical. That's the number one thing that needs to happen. It's one of the things I habitually see as a gap because a brand new graduate, he's like, gosh, I have a brand new platoon sergeant here that has like 14 years of experience. He's clearly deployed. What do I have to bring to the table? And it's a lot. It's a lot. And the institutional knowledge you gain through 4 years of serving here in West Point, and it's critical. And, you know, I talked about how we're going back from COIN to large-scale combat, from some of the efficiencies that we gained through the GWAT to re-blueing ourselves in doctrine and the importance of going back to that. We strayed away from that for quite a bit. And we did it because the Army was asking us to do a certain job.
Right.
And that job included creating new SOPs and new TTPs. But now we have to go right back to the books, understanding doctrine. And you guys will become masters of that, leaving here for 4 years. So I will start with that, is building that relationship of trust through good counseling and expectation management. Yeah.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah. So you were a platoon sergeant in the Ranger Regiment.
That's right.
Okay. So how did your relationship with your platoon leader work when you all were downrange? Because I've heard in the Ranger Regiment, it's almost unique. There's some important differences in that relationship.
That is correct. It's the first 12 years of my career were in one battalion.
Wow.
So when you talk about continuity, I know everybody. So when I say I know this private from when he was a private to when he was a squad leader, I have, and more than likely I have raised him. So your senior NCOs from the platoon sergeant level, they know their people inside and out. And they have, you know, really in E7 at the time, at this peak, probably had 6-7 combat rotations. So the experience was there. But at the end of the day, you know, we don't have brand new PLs. We don't have brand new company commanders in the Ranger Regiment. They're second time. So they've served and have been successful in a conventional unit before they actually compete and assess to become second time PLs, to become second time company commanders. So, you know, you're getting the top an excellent leader to begin with. But then, you know, you have to bring them into the fold and make them understand, because some of the experiences that you have, experiences they just haven't had, some of the assets, some of the systems that exist in USASOC are just not, you know, across a conventional force. So there's a lot of teaching going on. And it takes a good senior platoon sergeant to bring in that new PL. But again, you know, I always reminded them, I was like, this is not your first rodeo. This is your second rodeo. So I expect a little more from you.
Right.
And then we talked about, you know, help coach him through as to what is expected of him. And I said, what is it that you think I do for you? Again, you know, understanding each other and building that relationship early, quickly, because it sets a tempo for when, you know, you're in front of 36 to 40 Rangers who are looking at you to give them guidance.
So one of the great strengths of the American Army on the Officer Corps and NCO Corps is education. Mm-hmm. Army invests a lot in education of all of its personnel. So in terms of NCO education, what kind of things have you found the most valuable and what would you like to see more of?
Well, that's a great question, actually, because, you know, the question always comes up as to who's the responsibility, who's responsible for developing our future leaders. Does it rely on the institutional realm? Does it rely on the operational realm? You know, it's and I always, when I have this conversation, I always tell them, I've been in the Army 28 years and I have under 2 years collectively of that time was spent in schools. And that's taken like 9 months of, you know, that's our major academy,
right?
That's Ranger School and everything else I've done. So it's not in the institutional realm, you know, there's that relies on the operational realm who trains and certifies leaders. The institutional, the NCO educational system, it's changed quite a bit. It's getting better and better. And it's, you know, obviously we train for the test. So we know what the future is, large scale combat, you know, so we're starting to see a lot of changes that have happened. You know, we've gained 200 hours of, you know, distributed learning, DLC that went away, and that's being reinvested right now. We're going back to getting, you know, NCOs back into the field. What are those critical tasks that they need to know before they come out and become team leaders, before they come out and become squad leaders? There's going to be a focus on training management. That's another big thing. We habitually rely in company commands to understand that well. And I think that's something an E5, an E6 should have an idea. How do I train? You know, you're responsible for training individuals, teams, and sections. You should understand, have a good understanding of the ASAP training model. So a lot of that is being reinvested into our education system. And I think it has gotten better. It will continue to get better into the future.
So, Sergeant Major, before we started recording, you're here with General Raymond, and he's next door recording five questions with the general with one of our cadets. Sure. And we were discussing the Harding Project. He actually brought it up about writing in the profession. So do you think that it's useful for NCOs to write for the profession for publication as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think the Sergeant Major of the Army has done a good job at really working in tandem with the chief by creating the Muddy Boots Project, right? That is his efforts at in encouraging writing and encouraging participation in podcasts much like these to share experiences, because that's what it's all about. It's sharing the experience. Now, we as NCOs, we're not as comfortable as writing, right? And that's one of the challenges we have is helping our NCOs understand. But when you frame it from that perspective of sharing those experiences, whether they were at the GWAT and, you know, in the Army 15, 16 years, because once they're gone, they're lost. And I think his first article was really phenomenal. And I think we were all, every 4-star, 3-star in Division CSM right now scheduled to write one.
Oh, amazing.
That's right. And so what we're doing in the division right now is it's looking to incentivize writing as well to the lowest level. So we started this quarter. We're creating a newsletter, really, per se. And we look at it, try to keep it really simple. Let's write a newsletter quarterly. Obviously, for no surprise, the Ivy Division. And we're focusing really for us on our priorities, lethal teams being number one. And that's so what I foresee. See us doing our division is for the division CSM myself to create or open it up and then have every organization, not only the 4th Infantry Division, but Carson, you know, provide papers that are tied to the topic, tied to lethal teams, ready people, forward mindset, and peaks partnerships, which are priorities, and have them compete. And nothing crazy, 350 to 500 words,
right,
paragraphs. And that's from the E1 to the E5 to the E7 to the E8. And then publish these quarterly and have them share. And hopefully that gets after this fear of writing, of thinking you're writing this AP paper, you know, for college. So just need you to write and share your thoughts. We'll see. We're in quarter one, so we're actually starting to write right now. But yes, I think it's really good. It's communications, we always talk about it. You need to improve your communication skills as you progress through the ranks. So that's how you're value added. That's how you're able to convince people. That's how you get things for your organization that you otherwise will not do. And that just carries over more than vocal. It also carries over to writing. So
absolutely. And I think an important point of emphasis on that is that's one of the ways we take care of our troops.
That's right.
So if you want a promotion waiver for your E2 going to E3, you got to provide that packet. And when you write evals, et cetera, et cetera. Over my experience in the Army, that was a neglected skill. We always thought if you could run fast and had a short haircut, that's all you needed. But we need that and some writing as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And again, you know, we talked about the changes made to the NCO education system. And I think you see it, you know, through MLC, you see in the academy for sure. You know, there's a lot of writing that goes into that, a lot of critical thinking that you get graded on. So again, I think we're getting better each and every time. So
you're at the Modern War Institute right now, where we focus on the warfare of tomorrow. So what kind of things do you think junior leaders need to start preparing for now in order to be successful on tomorrow's battlefield?
There's a lot of things. You try to keep it simple. I try to keep it echelon. So war fighting is the reason we exist. And our message remains the same. It's regardless of MOS, your job is to fight and win our nation's wars when called upon. And that takes a lot of hard work, right? So our training methodology has to change. When you look at war fighting, particularly us inside of ForceCom, you know, how do we measure lethality? How do we make, you know, our tankers more accurate? How do we make our infantry more deadly in the battlefield, right? And we have been focusing on that, but particularly in our, you know, movement and maneuver and our marksmanship, how we approach those things both under day and night conditions. We create capstone exercises to push our soldiers to the limits and then ask them to do more after that, because that's what's going to be expected of them. You know, the days of where you're flying to the X and landing 300 meters from your target and running to blocking positions, blowing your breach. Those days are over. You're going to be in a contested environment where you will not be able to fly a helicopter anywhere near. So you may be walking 20, 30 miles, and guess what? You're probably carrying all your rations with you. You're probably carrying all your ammo because you're not going to have that perfect ring route that drops off all your ammo and your speedballs, right? So we're pushing our soldiers to stay longer in the field. Our units are doing much better. Lethal Ivy, as I mentioned earlier on, had three different brigades in the field for over 2 weeks.
Wow.
Training. And that's, and some of the soldiers was the first time that they've seen that, you know, because they're used to the 3 to 4 day field problems, and they come back in and reset. You know, okay, we go back out. No, prolonged training, prolonged suffering builds great formations, and it builds resiliency. That's first and foremost. So as a division, what do? We create opportunities, right? In the division, we've began changing the way we're building our ranges. We've created lethal ranges that stress the cognitive as well as physical of our soldiers. That's the best we can do. And then through reinforcement and QTVs and SATVs is ensuring that commanders are doing good training management and are pushing their units to accomplish their tasks.
So in terms of broadening assignments, there are a lot of NCOs that are here in the Department of Military Instruction in particular, but also as tactical officers, more or less first sergeants for the cadet companies. What kinds of broadening assignments for NCOs have you seen be really good for the NCO Corps?
Oh gosh, there's really a lot of them right now. And so I guess I will start first with the things that we know as an Army we need. We need great drill sergeants. They're building the future of our Army. Those are the first ones, ensuring you pick the right one, you know, who's going to develop future soldiers. Our recruiting, as you know, our accessions, they're not the best, but it's night and day. We've met our mark this year. We're scheduled to do even better next year. Our numbers already show that we're going to do better next year. So, you know, when you look at drill sergeant and our recruiters, those are the first things. Then I will tell you the schoolhouse. And again, the reason why I say that, because you know, the resident knowledge can either stay or die inside your brain. And, you know, so having those leaders with the war experiences to go back and give back to the community, whether through BLC, ALC, SLC, and beyond, it's critical. And that goes for IOBC and AOB, IBOLIC and ABOLIC as well, because you have NCOs there. So really, I would focus on those, first and foremost, what the Army needs, and then really the institution, making our people better for the future.
Okay. So where do you see yourself in a couple of years, Sergeant Major? We always like to look to the future as we're getting ready to wrap up.
That's a great question. You know, I'll continue to serve. I think it's an honor and a privilege to serve. I've been fortunate enough for the Army to believe I can continue to be value added to the organization. Fortunate to be an Ivy soldier now. I don't know where the future lies. I would certainly think that I want to continue to serve at higher echelons. I will leave it at that. Yes. But I think as long as the body still goes and my brain's still working, I think I'm excited to continue to serve.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Well, Sergeant Major, we also like to make sure our guests have the chance to talk about anything else that's on their mind, anything you want to emphasize, anything that's going on in the Ivy Division or the Army that you think would be important.
Well, I guess just to wrap up, the first and foremost, I will tell you is, one, I'm thankful for the invitation to come here and speak to you guys and for the cadets really and West Point and really ROTC or any other military academy. You know, I'd like to thank them for their service. I'd like to thank them for their sacrifice. Some of the sacrifices they've made already probably to get to where they're at now, some of the sacrifices that they don't even know they're going to make in the service to our nation. You know, I think the American people are truly indebted to you. It's hard being a soldier and it's certainly harder to be a leader, but it's a noble profession, the profession of arms. I think it's the most honorable profession out there. And I think you're making a great decision to come on board the team, and we're looking forward to actually adding you to the ranks in the near future.
Thank you, Sergeant Major. So, CB, do you have anything you want to ask him or say to him before we turn off the recorders?
I think something I'm curious about is what are things that you come back to personally as, you know, as a person, as kind of just, you know, the root identity of a soldier daily when you're carrying yourself, how you measure how you've done in a day?
That's good. So I've been fortunate, you know, as I said, 20 years in the regiment, I was assessed several times. They assess you to see if you're fit to continue to lead Rangers, because it's a huge responsibility. So I've grown up like that, and I think that's kind of been ingrained inside my mind. You know, you are a leader. You have to inspire people first and foremost. And every time I talk to people, I'm like, how are you better today than they were yesterday, right? And that's really the thing that I try. Like, I use that with our newcomers. I use that with my battalion, first CSMs, first sergeants. What have you done today for your formation? What have you done that's make your formation more lethal today than yesterday? Because the day you show up to work and say, hey, I got all this figured out, I tell you, that's the day you need to take your green suit off and hang it, because you're done, because you're going to be no value added. So constantly challenging yourself and challenging your formation, your subordinates, that's something I do. Every single day, there's something I'm fighting to learn today, asking questions. And you have to be humble enough to do that and have a good team surrounding you to make you the best leader. So you're constantly growing. You have to, and you have to have the mentality.
Sergeant Major, thanks for your time. This is going to be an excellent episode.
I appreciate the opportunity. Really, really excited. I'm looking forward to this Sunday.
Absolutely. Go Army. Beat Air Force.
Beat Air Force. That's right.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.